Radiotopia.
Welcome to the Kitchen Sisters present.
From PRX.
We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson
and Nikki Silva.
Hi, I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life in prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. The Kitchen Sisters Present is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
A truck in the parking lot outside Emergency at Cornell Medical Center, selling the best West Indian food in Manhattan. A secret Romanian restaurant tucked away in the back of a diamond shop in the Diamond District in Midtown. Whole goats grilling in the outfield at a softball game in Brooklyn's Red Hook Park. All these hidden kitchens, a half hour from my doorstep. And that's just my town. I'm Frances McDormand.
Today on The Kitchen Sisters Present, we bring you stories from our NPR series, Hidden Kitchens, about secret, underground, below-the-radar cooking, how communities come together through food, with host Frances McDormand.
I'm calling about a Friday night fish fry that's in my local community in Lake Waccamaw.
If you're looking for the ultimate hidden kitchen, it is our Meals on Wheels kitchen. You can't see it from the main street. There's no sign.
I work as a contract cook for science expedition trips on the Colorado River in Grand Canyon.
Message 15.
The cooking club is often the only chance that the ladies of Skid Row get to eat fresh food.
My family has a hidden kitchen in our barn near our house, and we used to cook our turkey in a trash can. For the men in the family, it's been a good chance to talk and sit around. And
we opened up a phone line on Morning Edition and asked NPR listeners to tell us about the hidden kitchens in their lives.
You have 62 new messages.
Hidden Kitchens Calling.
Message 1 was received.
Hello, this is Jay Allison. The Kitchen Sisters and I are gathering stories exploring the world of hidden kitchens. Who glues your community together through food, and where do they cook? Who are the local pioneers and kitchen visionaries? What food tradition is disappearing from your life? What should be captured and documented before it disappears or changes beyond recognition?
Mr. Bronson came to us on Thursday. He would load his pickup with delicatessen, and he had a scale on the back of the truck and a pickle barrel. And he would drive it through the various small towns of Delaware, Maryland, Virginia. Mr. Bronson would tell us stories about other Jewish families some 10 miles up the road, who was sick and who was dying and who was making some money. And he would just spread the gossip.
Your phone calls have poured in, filling dozens of tapes with hundreds of messages.
Hello, my name is Ellen Burkett Morris. I was calling to tell you all about a Kentucky tradition, burgoo, which is sort of a frontier stew, and it's served every year at the Kentucky Colonel's barbecue around derby time. They've got, you know, ladies in fancy hats sipping iced tea and old guys wearing really loud jackets who are talking, and the governor's always on hand greeting people and working the crowd. And they begin cooking in huge pots the night before, and they know when they're going to have a particularly good batch of burgoo when the cooking crew hears a plop in the middle of the night. Legend has it that there's a nest of black snakes in the trees above the kettles, and from time to time one of the snakes will climb out onto a limb to get a whiff of the stew and actually fall in.
Food triggers memory. You speak about food as a personal inheritance and connection to vanished generations, the secret ingredient of family. This is a call from Cornelia Lambert.
I'm calling about my grandmother's kitchen. She is an 84-year-old woman living in Mount Airy, North Carolina, and she builds community through food, not just the family community, which she's always feeding us, et cetera, but about 2 years ago, she started inviting people to dinner and charging them $10 a plate and all of the money she would give to Habitat for Humanity. And people turned their pockets inside out for some of Ruby's food.
You tell us about hidden efforts to save wasted food, or meals traded or offered in trust, an honor system based on pies. Some of your hidden kitchens are communal, some solitary, from the brutish pleasure of a ribeye fried with a quartered potato in the lonely kitchen of a recently divorced man, to the sober commitment behind little community kitchens that feed thousands of homeless people every day.
Hello, my name is Keith McHenry. One of America's largest kitchens, which is hidden, is called Food Not Bombs, and we cook free food that we hand out on the streets. Yet, in many parts of the United States, we've been arrested over 1,000 times for serving free food.
We've heard about kitchens reviving traditions, bringing back old recipes for saguaro cactus on a reservation in Arizona, or about men cooking in the dark over fire pits in the far north and the deep south, and the private, shared cooking that happens when babies are born and when people die. This is Emma Clark.
I grew up in Gainesville, Florida, and when my father died, my family got a pounding. A pounding happens when someone dies or a new minister moves into town or someone gets married or has a baby, and people from the community come by and give a pound of sugar, a pound of flour, a pound of butter, whatever they have. The pounding gave us a sense of really being at home.
Hi, I'm Delia Martinez. I am known to make good flour tortillas. I have a song that about tortillas that I would like to share with you. This is how it goes. There's no tortillas, there's only bread. There's no tortillas, I feel so sad.
Many of your calls are laments, not just for what we have left behind, but for what we will leave behind if we're not careful. People seem nostalgic even for the present.
Bologna sandwiches for funeral dinners.
Marilyn Fosberg.
This is a food tradition that is dying out. The little town of Brenton, Michigan is a ghost town now. But when my father owned a store there, he always donated ring bologna to the women that made the sandwiches. And you ground up the bologna, added homemade pickle relish and salad dressing, not mayonnaise. You serve this on white bread with coffee and iced tea, and it's a tradition that is dying out here because the women are getting too old and the young women are not doing it. And they're delicious sandwiches.
Some of your stories are not of our kitchens today, but of strange and hidden kitchens gone by.
Hi, my name is Sandra Sherman, and I'd like to talk to you at some length about turtle feasts in the 18th century and how turtle feasts were used as a way for men who were otherwise very civilized to come together to celebrate blood sports in a Beowulfian manner.
One caller told us about a lost kitchen he's hoping to find again. John Miller was a soldier in Vietnam who received a pineapple upside-down cake by mistake and couldn't forward it on before it would spoil, so he and his friends ate it and it was delicious, he said. He wrote the parents of the young soldier it was intended for.
Anyhow, I wrote to them and told them the situation and thanked them, and that I'd never got anything in the mail and all that kind of stuff. And they, in about 2 weeks, they sent me a tin of homemade chocolate chip cookies, and they were delicious. I kept their address for a long time, and I lost it, but they were from Connecticut. And if I still knew how to get in touch with them, I would. Bye.
If you happen to send sweets to a John Miller in Vietnam, we hope you will contact us. We'll put you in touch with him.
It's hard to describe why or how certain messages filter to the top. It was definitely not a scientific process. The calls began arranging themselves into themes. Endangered kitchens, immigrant kitchens, grandmother's kitchens, political kitchens, even kitchen music.
Hi, this is Don Rossler, and I'm sending you guys a song about a refrigerator, which, I guess is fairly essential in just about every kitchen. It's not only the center of activity, but also, for a lot of people, the emotional center. I don't mean just in terms of emotional comfort from food. It's where the pictures and drawings and stuck-up memos and Little League schedules and recipes hang. It's also, in a weird way, represents the people you've taken down off the fridge. I guess it's actually about family and whatever that is to you as well. You know, and the kitchen is where the family gathers and changes over the years, all represented in a sad and bittersweet song called Christine's Refrigerator.
I want my picture to stay upon Christine's refrigerator. Though I'm no longer with her, I wanna stay there, taped between her sister with her birthday cake, her little brother standing on his head. All my boxes have been moved. There's a TV I'll take later. We were happy, so I thought.
When we opened the Hidden Kitchens hotline on NPR, we asked, we pleaded, please don't tell us about your grandmother and her cooking. We know it sounds harsh, cold, heartless. Kitchens and grandmothers, the two are inextricably linked. But that's what we were afraid of. We knew if we gave grandmother stories an inch, the hotline would have a meltdown. It would be a torrent, a flood, an endless sea of grandmothers and their cookies, pies, and advice. Fortunately for us, most of you completely disregarded our plea and called up not once, not twice, but three times to tell us about, you guessed it, Grandma. Here are some little kitchen stories even the hard-hearted kitchen sisters could not resist.
My name is Douglas Weed. I have a story to tell about my grandma's kitchens. There was only one grandma at a time in my family. They rarely saw each other, didn't particularly like each other. I called them Little Grandma and Big Grandma. Little Grandma ate no seeds, no salt, no sugar, refused to make sauces, would not serve jams, berry pies, berry cobbler, berry pancakes. All meat was boiled or baked. Coarse whole wheat bread was served with salt-free oatmeal for breakfast. Lots of plain boiled vegetables. Canned sugar-free fruit for dessert. For a little boy of the 1950s, this was a tough assignment. Any meal at Little Grandma's house was a challenge. The solid, plain, oh-so-plain food, and not much of it. Big Grandma, by contrast, produced dinners to die for. Her table was covered with china serving bowls filled with chicken gravy, gravy-soaked biscuits, another with hot biscuits, two kinds of jam, honey still in the comb, the chicken in its own bowl, and sweet, milky coleslaw, the kind you want to drink as much as chew, maybe a plate of ham or sausages, fresh fruit swimming in condensed milk. These were artery-clogging, jack-up-the-blood-pressure, eat-till-you-burst dinners and picnic lunches and breakfast with waffles and pancakes and homemade maple syrup. Big Grandma loved to make decorated two-layer buttercream frosted cakes, yellow, white, spiced, chocolate. You could have whatever flavor you wanted. I loved my grandmas. Little Grandma was as sad and troubled as her food was plain. Big Grandma was as happy and thoughtful as her table was loaded. Both lived into their 80s. Little Grandma died depressed and a bit demented. She lingered. Big Grandma died of high blood pressure and diabetes. A little artery blew up in her head. She fell to the floor, dead in mid-sentence. No surprises for either, I suppose. They died as they lived, as they cooked in their nearly identical kitchens.
An unexpected kitchen, the George Foreman Grill.
Message 23 was received at 1:10 p.m. today.
Yes, I'm Margaret Engel, co-author of Food Finds. The George Foreman Grill has been an amazing success story as a kitchen appliance, but what I think many people don't realize is that immigrants and low-income people, the people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like, and it's a much safer way than a hot plate. That is, to me, the epitome of the hidden kitchen.
Wow, what a wonderful story. I'd never considered it at all. I'm George Foreman, two-time heavyweight champion of the world, former Olympic champion, and king of the grills. Growing up in Houston, Texas, my whole life was spent trying to get enough to eat. Having seven kids, my mother did, and there just was never enough food for me. I always dreamed about not a car, not a beautiful home, but enough to eat.
My name Piggly Wiggly. I've got groceries on my shelf.
My name is Jeffrey Newton, Chicago. I'm a great cook, a trait that I had learned from my grandmother, but I just haven't had a kitchen. I'm living in a shelter at this particular time, but I've been homeless all my life. I lived under Wacker Drive, where the expressway goes through, and there's about 30 or 40 refrigerator boxes down there. That's going to be your home. I would get a George Foreman grill. That's the grill that I had for a while under Wacker Drive, me and a fellow by the name of Smokey. So you just get your long extension cord. Well, they got a lot of electrical plugs on the poles down there. And just hook up. We was making hamburgers and grilled cheese sandwiches. Because we used to take an iron and do that too. Press down, you know, your bread and your cheese.
My name is Pat Sherman, and I'm the program coordinator of the Walk-In Center here at Glide, San Francisco. When I was in these single room occupancies, I couldn't cook in my room. Well, legally, I couldn't. I'd get me a big bowl, put me some ice in it, and voila, that became my refrigerator. Microwaves, toaster ovens, hidden under the bed or in the closet. The George Foreman grill, that's the newest thing. Doesn't set off the smoke detectors. And since they come in colors, you know, it just looks like you're getting real fancy in your room and decorating. And it looks like you have a nice tabletop to the visible eye. But you know it's your kitchen.
It's a special TV offer from the king of the grill, George Foreman.
My lean, mean, fat-reducing grilling machine.
I grew up in Houston, Texas, in the Fifth Ward area. Every day at lunch during the summer days, you'd hear the parents call the kids in. They would just tell me, okay, go home and eat your lunch. And these people knew I had no food at home. And I'd peep through the window at the kids eating, and the parents would peel the crust off the bread, and I would sit there and just hope they would just throw it out the window for me. Going to school, you go through the lunch line, 26 cents. I couldn't afford that. And I'd sit at the table, and it was so embarrassing. So what I would do, I'd get a greasy bag, blow it up on the way to school to make it look like there was a sandwich in it. Then I'd get to my classroom and say, boy, I ate my lunch. And I learned to disguise my not having food.
When you're homeless, you have to find out all these things, you know. It's called trailblazing. You got to blaze the trail, you know. A lot of times we went into the hospitals, it was either to sleep or to use the microwave. You know, going, I'm coughing. You know, and when they call your name, you don't answer. And you got a band around your wrist. So now you can sit there half the night and go to sleep. Or if I'm downtown, I go to one of these office buildings and they got a microwave and I run in there. You know, I mean, I wasn't there to steal anything like that. I just wanted to pop my popcorn. Sometimes I survived on popcorn.
I did the crock pot thing. And I made it look like a flower pot. When I got ready to use it, I took my flower pot out of it, put my things in, then went to work and came home and had dinner. You make a kitchen for yourself so that you can survive.
I try to conceal my lack of things by fighting all the time. Pretty soon, I became an expert at fighting. I never did get good at schoolwork. Finally, I became a dropout, and I became a mugger. I actually mug people.
I think hunger makes you angry.
Hello, this is Jackie Gleason, talking to you about the Job Corps.
I heard about the Job Corps. If you're looking for a second chance to get an education, join the Job Corps. In the 65, I went to Grants Pass, Oregon. I had 3 meals for the first time in my life. It took me about 2 months before I realized, hey, they're going to have breakfast every day. And it changed my whole life. I started reading books. I started doing assignments. Richard Kibble, I'll never forget Richard Kibble from Seattle, Washington. And he always had a book he'd read. Sort of a hippie fella. And when I'd boast about how I was going to fight, he said, listen to this. And he'd bring out this fella he called Bob Dylan. Oh, boy, I'd never heard anyone sing songs that had meaning to them. And I'd sit on the side of his bed and listen. He said, watch this, listen to this. And in other words, everything I was doing was physical, brutal. And I started to admire something about him, what he had on his mind. I would not feel so all alone, but everybody must get stoned.
They'll stone you when you're at the breakfast table. They'll stone you when you are on your table.
For a while there, I was selling plates of food to the other homeless people. You know, they had to come up with a little money. They gave us a room at the YMCA over on the west side. I started cooking for everybody, even though we weren't supposed to be cooking up there. I could take food depository food and do wonders with it, you know, canned chicken, canned pork. We had our door wide open. I turned the music on. They know once they hear the music on, Jeff's cooking. It wasn't legal at all.
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! The heavyweight champion is taking the mandatory 8-count, and Foreman is as poised as can be.
In 1977, when I left boxing, I realized I didn't have any friends. People weren't pouring into my home anymore. And I noticed if I'd barbecue something, they would come over. Even the guys would go fishing. I wanted them to stay and come back so much, I would always clean the fish, do all the cooking. I found out more satisfying than even winning boxing matches when people would lick their fingers and say my food was good. That grill, I'm just happy that it's helped so many people, helped me, of course. My brother Roy and I started the George Foreman Youth Center. I have these summer camps so the kids can know to come. They can have a lunch every day. Just had to be there for them. I'll never forget. And I'm pushed and compelled. I mean, there's a food bank. All you got to do is ask George Foreman. If I can find a dime, I want to make sure you get it. And I try to keep those little visions alive for myself. Feed them.
My name, Piggly Wiggly. I've got groceries on my shelf. My name, Piggly Wiggly. I've got groceries on my shelf. Getting tired, making these nights all by myself.
We'll be right back. The Kitchen Sisters Present is supported by Sakara, a nutrition company that focuses on overall wellness, starting with what you eat. You want to stay healthy, but you also want to enjoy your meals. With Sakara, you get nutritious meals that nourish your body without sacrificing taste. Sakara is based on a whole food, plant-rich diet, full of hydrating produce and nutrient-dense superfoods. At Sakara.com, you'll find specially tailored meal plans, gift ideas, healthy snacks, and support.
This is especially great during the busy eat too much holidays when you're trying to keep your life and diet on track. And right now, Saqqara is offering our listeners 20% off their first order when they go to saqqara.com/kitchensisters or enter Kitchen Sisters at checkout. That's Saqqara, SAKARA.com/kitchensisters to get 20% off your first order. Saqqara.com/kitchensisters.
A Secret Civil Rights Kitchen. Georgia Gilmore and the Club from Nowhere.
You have 52 new messages.
Hey, my name's John T. Edge, and I live down in Oxford, Mississippi, and direct the Southern Foodways Alliance. There's a woman y'all need to know about. Her name's Georgia Gilmore. She was a cook in the 1950s in Montgomery, Alabama. And when I think of Hidden Kitchens, I think about the story of her backdoor restaurant, her secret kitchen that fueled the civil rights movement.
Hey, how you doing? You live on the street. Do you know where Miss Gilmore used to stay?
Yeah, Miss Georgia Gilmore. That's Miss Gilmore house down there. You see that marker down there, that historical marker?
Oh, yeah, I see it now. You see the plaque in the yard?
Georgia Teresa Gilmore. I'm her son, Councilman Mark Gilmore, Jr.
Georgia Gilmore.
She could cook.
1920, 1990.
She was a stone cook.
Her food was cooked on the mama level. And Georgia was like Big Mama. Southern type mamas, maybe 10 or 15 of them.
Now, my mother at the time was a midwife by profession. She cooked at National Lunch Company in Montgomery when the movement started. When Mrs. Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give up her seat in 1955, Mama got involved in the bus boycott.
She lost her job because management learned of her being a part of this movement that was going on. My name is Johnny Rebecca Carr, and I am the fifth president of the Montgomery Improvement Association.
Stop that Alabama bus. I don't want to ride.
During the bus boycott, City of Montgomery brought suit against King and 90 other members of the Montgomery Improvement Association in March of 1956. They were claiming that the bus boycott was an unlawful conspiracy. Georgia Gilmore testified in court. She, in essence, called out this bus driver who had kicked her off a bus. When Miss Gilmore stood up in court, she got fired.
You cannot be afraid if you want to accomplish anything. You got to have the will and the spirit, and above all, you got to have the get up.
Everybody could tell you Georgia Gilmore didn't take no junk. I'm Reverend Al Dixon. If you pushed her too far, she'd say a few bad words, and if you pushed her any further, she'd hit you.
She was swift on her feet. She could move. Mama weighed about 350, 400 pounds. Martin Luther King would call her tiny.
God is a battle axe.
She lived about three blocks from where Reverend King was living at the time. I'm a Nelson Malden. Reverend King, when he came to Montgomery, I was his first barber. Whenever VIPs would come to town, he would always have Miss Gilmore to cook up a batch of chicken. When she was fired from a restaurant, Reverend King said, well, why don't you go in business for yourself?
She turned part of her home into a dining area. Dr. King and the organization helped her to set up where she could go into business cooking in her own home.
Dr. Martin Luther King, he needed a place where he could go, where he could not only trust the people around him, but trust the food.
Plus, they had a lot of secret meetings, and they didn't want nobody to know, so they went to Georgia House.
My name is Martha Hawkins at Martha's Place Restaurant.
She inspired me to be able to do what I'm doing.
I'm Pastor Thomas E. Jordan, Lily Baptist Church, Montgomery, Alabama. About 12 o'clock, we'd make a beeline to Georgia Gilmore's place. A lot of times you have to wait in line to be fed.
Why don't you sit down? I can't sit down.
And as these would leave, another set would come, just like a Methodist communion table. I'm Althea Thomas. I'm organist here at Dexter Avenue, King Memorial Baptist Church. Sometimes there would be about four professors, clerical workers, a policeman or two.
Lawyers and doctors, black and white. People like Mars Dees with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
She could talk on everybody's level, a confidant. Know what's going down, know what's up.
Kennedy came, Johnson's been here, Dr. King brought him. Wallace. All of them had a chance to eat at my mother's table. She called you little names, you know. Come here, little heifer.
She'd be cooking that chicken. Sometimes she'd take it right out the grease and put it on your plate. You just eat wherever you could find a seat. Stand up and eat whatever.
Well, I say, come here, black woman. Don't you hear me crying? Oh, Lordy.
Pork chops. Stuffed bell peppers. Where she cooked pound cake. A 7-up cake.
Went all through my kitchen. All through my dining room. Don't you hear me crying, doggone your pretty back soul. And all through my kitchen.
She would have chitlins with slaw. And they'd take the hog maw and cut up in them. She would make banana pudding and would make it slap your brains out. She could cook it, man.
Oh, Lordy.
The bus boycott lasted for 381 days. Georgia Gilmore, another phase of her work was that she had a group called the Club from Nowhere. She just made it up in her mind to start raising money for the movement.
Aren't you hungry? Well, why not buy a pie from the ladies of the boycott?
They sold pies and cakes in the beauty shops. A lot of them was afraid to let people know who they was, so they called themselves the Club from Nowhere.
They bought the station wagons for different churches. That's how they organized transportation. In every mass meeting, Dr. King would preach, and she would turn that money in. She raised more money than anybody there.
Oh, Lordy.
Georgia Gilmore died on a Friday, on the 25th anniversary of the Civil Rights Selma to Montgomery March. She was fixing food for the marchers. And at the visitation, her family served it to the mourners.
She cooked that morning a tub of macaroni and cheese, and she would have fixed a tub of chicken. She was getting ready to cook heavy to help feed the people. And she died.
Well, I think Georgia Teresa Gilmore was one of the unsung heroines of the civil rights movement. You know, Martin Luther King often talked about the ground crew. She was not really recognized for who she was. But had it not been for people like Georgia Gilmore, Martin Luther King Jr. wouldn't have been who he was.
It seems like it's raining all over the world. I feel like it's raining all over the world.
Sheriff Michael Hennessy, A Prison Kitchen Vision.
My name is Mike Hennessy. I'm the sheriff of the city and county of San Francisco and have been elected 7 times to this job. And all you have to do is watch some of the old prison movies and you'll see that every jail riot starts in the dining room. Food is very important.
Sheriff Michael Hennessy knows this. He tells the Kitchen Sisters this. Yet the head of the 20th largest jail system in America has agreed to allow 2 San Francisco chefs and their crews to come into his jail with knives and forks and organic vegetables and teach 40 women prisoners how to cook healthy, affordable food, which they will sit down and eat together.
People who run jails are either naturally or paid to be suspicious and paranoid. And a kitchen is a place that's got knives, forks, metal things that we have to keep track of. There are always concerns about the level of security. That's the constant yin and yang of providing programs in jails and prisons. The safest thing to do is provide no programs whatsoever. The safest thing to do is to lock someone in their cell 23 hours a day and let them out for 1 hour of recreation. But that's not necessarily the best thing for the community. A couple of restaurateurs, Tracy Desjardins and Larry Bain, approached me and said they would like to do a cooking class inside of the jail. How to purchase healthy food, how to prepare healthy food. After I thought about it a little bit, I thought it sounds like a very good idea. The 2 restaurateurs involved have restaurants where the meals are very nice and very expensive, but the women, when they get out, they may be creating their food budget off of food stamps. And so Larry and Tracy and their staff have to gear their teaching skills to the lives of the women who are going back into a very poor community, where they can't spend a couple of hours dawdling at the farmer's market looking for the best radicchio or something like that. If you can start by convincing people that I don't know nothing about cooking, okay, you're going to learn something here and you're going to create a marvelous meal. All of a sudden you get more confidence about your abilities to do other things. We need to get people who are going back into our community from jail in a mindset where they believe they can achieve. Otherwise, they're just going to continue to sell drugs, use drugs, and be criminals and come back to jail.
A friend of mine, when she was in jail, told me about how the women really had this yearning to cook, even in their limited circumstances. And a lot of it was food that just had to be built from the vending machines.
I know a million ways to cook top ramen.
Alfredo over ramen by crushing up potato chips.
We would take a base of ramen noodles, and they would take pieces of paper and fold them and stick them through the bars. And they would have a matron bring a cup of hot water and dump the hot water down the paper to run into the ramen cup. And then they would mix with the ramen slices of Slim Jim and then crush Cheetos on the top to make kind of a little soup, which she said she still has a taste for to this day. She said there was one woman who really wanted to make desserts for people in her cellmates, and she would take some of the Hostess products and things from the vending machine and kind of separate them out and take the little cream icing out and the cream inside and kind of mush the pastry parts together and put the cream back in and make these little cakes. She would go around offering pieces of this to people. And it just really, to me, spoke of this, no matter where you are, there's this need to touch and cook and serve.
A lot of Kitchen Sisters stories are born in taxicabs. Hidden Kitchens was conceived in the back of a Yellow.
Where's anybody now for Clay and front for the Alcala?
24, Clay Montalbano.
And 24...
Davia lives in San Francisco and hates to drive. She started noticing that every time she got into a Yellow cab, the driver was from Brazil.
You usually take a cab or what?
Not just from Brazil, but from the same town in Brazil, Goiânia. Inevitably, these cab ride conversations turn to music and food.
Jeanette, right? She does a couple of things, also snacks, pão de queijo. It's like a cheese bread.
That's when the story of Jeanette emerged, a woman from their same hometown who comes every day after dark to the abandoned industrial street outside the cab company and sets up a makeshift rolling night kitchen. By dawn, Jeanette and her blue tent are packed up and gone. One night, around midnight, they decided to go in search of this secret cab yard kitchen. A driver had given them a sketchy map and told them to park in the cab lot and walk to Jeanette's outpost from there. Just look like you know where you're going, he said. They walked through the fleet of parked cabs, past a graveyard shift mechanic working on a taxi up on the racks, past the checkout point, and out onto a street in the middle of nowhere. There, under a streetlight and a small blue tarp, huddled over big plates of food, four drivers were laughing, eating in Portuguese. Brazilian music spilled out of a parked cab. Jeanette, shy and smiling, presided. A hidden kitchen vision.
After midnight, that's when the big crowd come over. Taxi drivers come by all the time.
It's just kebab and rice and beans and chicken. Eugene. This is Manjar.
I drive Yellow Cab. She comes here and cooks for us. You know?
The sidewalk in the middle of nowhere, in full moon, but covered with haze. And
yeah, that was good last
on a blue tent in front of the garage of Yellow Cab San Francisco.
She's here till 4, 6, 7 in the morning.
I'm from Brazil. It's about 386 Brazilians driving a cab. Jeanette's food feel like home.
My name is Jeanette. I make a cooking. Abrir business, small business. Aqui, só para a comunidade da Yellow Cab.
Jeanette's Cab Yard Kitchen.
If Jeanette was making rice and beans on this street at midnight, gathering her community like a campfire, who else was out there cooking on some other corner? What other tiny kitchen economies, clandestine cooking, and secret kitchen rituals were waiting to be discovered? They began noticing things. A woman surreptitiously selling tamales out of a baby carriage in downtown Santa Cruz. An after-hours restaurant tucked away in a car wash in L.A. Vietnamese manicurists gathered for a Christmas Eve feast of pho and fish in a neighborhood nail salon in San Francisco. Once they started looking, they found unexpected, improvised, tiny kitchen cultures in places and at times of day they never thought to look before. Their journey began. The Kitchen Sisters take us to the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota for the wild rice season and the harvest on Big Rice Lake.
They call it the Ricing Moon. It's the name of the month, really, the Ricing Moon. It's like naming it September or something.
The Wild Rice Making Moon, Menominicay Geezes. We got a lot of rice on this reservation. It's a tall grass. It grows up, you know, all over our lakes. We got 47 lakes. And who lives up here is Ojibways and ducks. My name is Winona LaDuc. I live and work on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. And I direct the White Earth Land Recovery Project, which is working to protect our wild rice. Ah, this is like one of the biggest times in our community. As soon as it starts coming up, there's bantering about which lakes look good and where they're going to go ricing. These guys are excited about it, to get rice for their family, and they're going to get to sell that rice. These guys are making a couple grand, a lot of them. When he got maybe 60% unemployment, that's a lot of money.
I ain't going to say easy money because it's not easy money. It's fast money. I put a lot of school clothes on my kids because it's that part of the year. I am Ron Chilton, White Earth Land Recovery Project.
I hope this canoe holds.
You usually try to tie your canoe on the night before. The canoe being tied on is a sign of honor. Our community, if your canoe falls off the car on the way to ricing, it's really a shame. And you know if it falls off, someone will see you. You drive out there to your lake, you and your partner unload your canoe and you drag it down there, and you know, it's already a workout.
Perfect.
Yeah. It's like heavy, and you know,
perfect.
We're a lot more sedentary these days.
There's your canoe.
Although, you know what, a lot of these guys are pretty buff looking.
The farther in the back, the better. Going into the race.
You get out there on the lake and it's misty. So it's just this beautiful like fog on the lake. It's quiet. There's nothing except for them birds. One guy stands in the back and he has a pole. It's tall. Right in front of him sits this person who's gonna knock. And they have these two long cedar sticks known as knockers. Bawa Iganuk, that's what they're called, but everybody just calls them knockers and then they laugh, you know, Ojibwe humor. So you go out there and you pull your rice across your lap and then you run the second knocker kind of diagonally across. And you hear the rice fall into your canoe, like that.
But you don't want to hit it too hard, then you knock the heads in. And if some fall in the lake, that's better. You're reseeding the lake.
Go back and forth and back and forth. You kind of try to keep some rhythm.
This is what you call crowfoot rice. See how it is?
Some looks like crow's feet. Some looks like a bottle brush. And it ripens at different times. They go and they start trying to domesticate varieties that would ripen at the same time. But they are not diverse. They're monocrop. And they put them in diked rice paddies. A lot of times they're using fungicides and chemicals, and they go in and harvest it with a combine. That's different than two Indians in a canoe. They're trying to call it wild rice, but that's not wild rice. We call that tame rice. And it doesn't taste the same. Our rice tastes like a lake. It tastes like a lake.
My name's Ed Barnett, and when I was growing up, the whole community would get together to go out racing, and it'd be like a caravan, and everybody just come right to the lake and help each other getting their boats out, and it was something to see, the young helping the old, and the old teaching the young how to do it through the whole process of gathering, harvesting, feasting.
Each season, we feast our foods. I serve the guys in the rice mill. There's like six guys working there. You know, in Minnesota, they call everything a darn hot dish. It's like wild rice, and I had some squash that I grew, and our buffalo meat. We now have this rice mill All our equipment is kind of handmade. You know that old Johnny Cash song, I got a 47, 48, 49? You know, that's what that equipment's like. But you got something that's made by five or six handy guys, and it's running off of a tractor.
Well, I'm Pat Wicker, and I work for the White Earth Land Recovery Project. My job title is Sustainable Communities Coordinator Assistant, or something like that. Well, I'm the parcher. That's what we call it when we're cooking this, parching rice. Yeah. I cook on average 1,800 pounds a day. I can pretty much tell by the way the rice sounds in the barrel. When it's almost done, it makes like a sizzling, hissing almost. When it's getting close, I just go stand by the barrel and I listen to the rice.
We sell a lot to some food co-ops, and we sell a lot mail order. Hand-harvested, wood-parched, native wild rice. Maple syrup, buffalo meat, and jams made with honey. In a community that's got the poorest counties in the state of Minnesota, I didn't want to try to bring in some factory on my reservation. They always are training and retraining our people. Training it for a job that doesn't exist, you know, and then he goes, tries to work in a border town. He cannot get hired. You make them feel like they're not going to be any good. And what we decide to do is say, what we got is something that we're good at. And what we are really good at is racing, instead of trying to make up some economy that makes no sense to us.
I do pretty much anything and everything, I guess, from maple syruping in the springtime to planting the fields. We build wind generators in the greenhouses and then solar panels.
Our wild rice is centerpiece of our culture, but what we're talking about here is how you get healthy. You know, your body and your community, and they're all related. It is not something that you can go buy, you know, at the store, your culture. You have to live it.
Wild rice, chokeberry jelly, fried bread mix, hominy, buffalo sausage, birch bark baskets. The White Earth Land Recovery Project helps support its community by selling traditional foods and crafts in its tiny native harvest store, 30 miles from the nearest town. Oh, and on the World Wide Web. Florence Goodman.
My name is Florence Goodman, Native Harvest. I make jams, jellies, and I experiment a lot in here. I was never meant to be a cook until they gave me a kitchen that I could, you know, I was like a mad scientist. We buy from people in reservation. People that need money, they'll go out and pick chokecherries and come sell them over here, and they sell the cranberries, plums. We put signs up all over, buying berries, buying rice, buying this, buying that.
I came home to dance to that big drum. I came home to have some fun. Kamachina Beji Kwe. One day soon I'm gonna find me one. One day soon I'm gonna find.
Winona LaDuke.
My mother comes from New York, and her parents were Jewish immigrants from the Ukraine. And my grandparents on my mother's side, where my grandmother worked in the pocketbook factory all her life. But before that, they were farmers, you know, because everybody was a farmer there. And you know, the story is that my great-grandfather was a miller. So he milled wheat in the Ukraine, and he was put out of business by someone who had a coal-powered mill, because he had a windmill. At this point in my life, I'm working on putting up wind turbines. So I feel like I'm working on this process of kind of rectifying. About 80 years later, I'm going to put up those wind turbines that my great-grandfather had. My father, he was a White Earth Ojibwe, and he comes from a really traditional family. He was the one who spent all his time in the woods. And he decided that he was going to go sell wild rice in New York. He drove out his one Indian card, and he was selling wild rice. So here I am. I find that I'm working on the same things my father and my great-grandfather worked on. And it takes really a long time to solve problems, you know? And so my mother met my father, selling wild rice in New York 46 years ago. Her name is Betty LaDuke. She's an artist. big paintings. She was this really amazing artist that was living like in a loft. And she was hanging out with all the hip, radical artists, socialist people. I mean, like, my mother was like a, you know, contemporary of Diego Rivera. And my grandparents, they didn't understand what he was. The quote is, oh, he's not a goy. He's not a Jew. What is he? They had no conceptual framework for an Anishinaabe, you know. Oh, so that's why they had to run off, you know. And so they eloped. They get in the car and they drive to L.A. in the Rambler, where the Westerns are starting to film. And so there's all these Indians that are in the Westerns. And my dad must have got wind of that. My dad was a real handsome guy, you know, and he could ride a horse and he looked like a real Indian and all, you know. He used to ride horses and fall off horses. That's what he did for a living. So I was born in East L.A. When we was little, my dad used to hunt in Santa Barbara and in Pasadena, and we ate all this wild food, plus that wild rice. And then my mother on the other side, they never cooked out of a box. They were frugal people from the Ukraine, and everything was from scratch. So that's how I was raised, is always eating food like that. My dad was an interesting man. His name was Vincent LeDuc. He became known as a man named Sun Bear. You know, he just believed that people should get back in touch with Earth. You know, and he had a set of teachings, and his teachings were kind of more, you know, Ojibwe-based, but kind of a, how that is translated. But he had one saying that I use, which is, I don't want to hear your philosophy if it doesn't grow corn.
Hidden Kitchens, produced by Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, The Kitchen Sisters, with Jay Allison, in association with Chicago Public Radio, mixed by Jim McKee at Earwax Productions, produced in collaboration with Laura Folger, Kate Falkman, Melissa Robbins, and Mariah Walcott, Wiesław Pogorzelski, Charles Prentice, Jeremiah Moore, and Andrew Roth, Vicky Merrick, Chelsea Mertz, Sydney Lewis, Helen Woodward, and Ali Burlow at Atlantic Public Media, Shula Newman in WCPN Cleveland, Martha Hamm in Alabama, and Jamie York in New York. Special thanks to Jim Anderson and Alex Cass at New York University. Mark Thompson is our executive producer. Major funding for Hidden Kitchens was provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. For NPR's Hidden Kitchens, I'm Frances McDormand. The Kitchen Sisters Present is produced by The Kitchen Sisters with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell. We're part of PRX's Radiotopia, a curated network of independent producers creating some of the finest podcasts around. Follow us at Kitchen Sisters on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and our website has news about workshops and projects and internship programs. Take a look at kitchensisters.org. Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia. From PR.